Welcome to the Spectator podcast with me, Fraser Nelson. This week, we'll be discussing the return of political lying, speaking to Steve Hilton about his case for Brexit, and talking about the shortage of marryable men and the lengths to which women now have to go to find a match. First up, the lying game. In his cover piece this week, Peter O'Born says that David Cameron and George Osborne are using the sort of techniques of deception deployed by New Labour in the run-up to the Iraq War. But Matthew Paris, in his column, says that in politics there's no point complaining about being lied to. That's the cry of the bad loser. They both join me now. Peter, you wrote a book on the rise of political lying. At the time you said it was Labour malaise. Do you really think the Tories are now just as bad?
Very much so. There was something very new about the what I really call the New Labour epistemology, which took away truth from its normal meaning and turned it into an instrument of power. And it really, truth was what you said it was. And they used that in all kinds of ways to sell the New Labour narrative and ultimately to sell the case for war with the various dodgy dossiers and the frequent misstatements, false statements, lies uttered by Blair and his ministers. And we know about that process, and we'll learn about it in more detail, I imagine, with the Chilcot report. When David Cameron turned up as leader of the Conservative Party, I think it is fair to say that he offered a return to a more traditional political discourse. But what has happened in the last, really quite recently, the last couple of years, last year really, is that mendacity and fabrication and deception have re-entered political discourse from the very top. That's very troubling, and it's now part of the campaign to keep Britain in the European Union.
Matthew, do you see any comparison between the tricks Tony Blair was up to and what David Cameron is doing now for the referendum?
Yes, I do. I think there are many parallels between the way Blair sold the Iraq war and the way that Cameron and co. are selling staying in the European Union. The problem is that the Iraq war was a mistake, and Saddam Hussein did not have the means or the weapons of destruction, probably not the intention that Tony Blair believed he did. The question with the European Union is whether staying in the European Union is the same sort of mistake on the same kind of scale. But Peter's perfectly right. That, I'm afraid, is how modern politicians do sell things. Tony Blair genuinely believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was a threat to world peace. But what he didn't know was what he pretended to know, the various facts and dressed allegations up as facts. David Cameron genuinely and George Cameron genuinely believe that if we leave the European Union, we will take a terrific economic hit and we'll all be the poorer for it. They do believe that. What they don't know is the pretend forecasts that and the entirely dreamed up numbers that politicians tend to attach to what are basically their hunches. Now, I happen to think that David Cameron's hunches is right, but I agree that he's going about selling it in the way Tony Blair sold his, and to some extent Margaret Thatcher sold hers. I think what's happened with Peter, is that you've got religion, you've got Brexit, and once you get religion, you start seeing the world in completely different ways, and you've started to see how politicians sell their case. But actually, it's how politicians always sold their case. It's just that you're so angry with this case that you've become almost neurologically sensitive to the way politicians go about things.
Peter? I think that you are wrong in saying, Matthew, that all politicians do this. I can name you loads and loads of politicians who wouldn't have done it. And one of them actually is the one you often defend rather well. I think John Major. I don't think that John Major went around inventing facts, manipulating statistics to make his cases. And I don't think that, say, John Smith, Ken Clark, these are all people. The idea that all politicians are liars and therefore we just got to accept that and that's how politics is, and I think you would agree with me, is a false interpretation of how politics is.
Yes, there's certainly better and worse. You've cited some of the better ones. I might cite Harold Wilson, amongst another twister. We get them all the time. I dare say that in the run-up to and during the Second World War, the government was guilty of dressing up things as facts that were not facts on a scale that would absolutely dwarf what government is doing now. It does happen from time to time.
But Matthew, there is such a thing as basic standards of honesty and accuracy. I mean, as a journalist, you're subject to it. If you were to make a false statement, the press regulator would come after you, and quite right too. Doesn't curb your freedom of expression, but it quite rightly stops columnists from making things up. So why shouldn't the same standards apply to politicians?
What Osborne and Cameron have done in the case of all these projections of apocalypse isn't exactly make things up. It is dress up what are basically their guesses about the future, as though there were any hard numbers that you could attach to them. And I'm afraid that is something that everybody does in journalism and in politics. So it isn't that David Cameron has said, you know, there's a bear behind that tree, when it's demonstrable that there isn't a bear behind that tree. He said, I have every reason to believe there's a bear behind that tree, and we can't actually prove it one way or the other.
Now, Peter, you say that Cameron and Osborne started out rather well with a commitment to returning honesty to politics. What do you think has changed?
Yes, I'm puzzled about this. I mean, Matthew, I think, rather attributed motive to me. He said I'd got Brexit, and this explained how I was now, what I was now saying. I don't like to attribute motive. But it is certainly the case that over the last year or just over more, that the relationship between Osborne and Cameron with the truth has changed. And I do think they are everything depends. The whole legacy of the Cameron years, the whole meaning of the Cameron premiership depends on the results of this referendum, which, and I do think it has meant that they have abandoned the scrupulousness which was a feature of the first feature of the first 10 years in office. I do, and I'd like to make 10 years as leader. I'd like to make a point here that had that Treasury document been a City of London prospectus produced by a company in order to sell its shares on the stock exchange, all of these sort of these fantasy ideas which Matthew's described so eloquently, I mean, would have ended up, Mr. Cameron, Mr. Osborne and their various promoters in court, almost certainly. It would have been a fraudulent prospectus. The obligations under the Companies Act on a company selling shares on the stock exchange are quite rigorous. And I don't fully understand why we should be Blair and Campbell sold the Iraq war on the basis of a false prospectus 10 years ago. We're now being sold the European Union on the basis, as Matthew honestly accepts, on a false prospectus. Isn't that a form of fraud on the electorate?
The legal constraints on people selling products or companies are very much greater than the legal constraints on politicians making promises and prospectuses about the future.
There aren't any constraints on politicians. Apart from politics.
No, that's not right. In advertising, in the law governing advertising, that's what's known as a puff. And a puff is not a deceit if it's part of an advertisement. You can say probably the best lager in the world, and no one is you can't be taken to court for that, because it's a puff. But that's what politicians do. They puff things. And were we to subject politics to the kind of legal constraints that Peter is suggesting, it wouldn't just be the Remain side, for instance, the Leave side, who consistently claim that the EU costs us X million pounds a week, and don't point out that they're offering a gross figure rather than a net figure, would always also end up in court. Almost everyone would end up in court.
I completely agree with Matthew, by the way, that the No side is wrong and culpable in misrepresenting how much money we give into the European Union. But there is a difference, and this is the use of the apparatus of the British state by the pro-EU side, the way in which the Treasury and other government departments are utilised to sell this false message. And I think that the British state, and again, I'm not cynical about this, the British state has a long tradition of political integrity and political impartiality. And what does distress me, that just as in 2002, the Secret Intelligence Service became part of the propaganda wing of the Blairite battering ram to war. Now the Treasury is becoming the propaganda wing of the pro-Europeans.
Peter Reborn and Matthew Paris, thanks very much. Now, the Brexit debate has just been spiced up by the intervention of Steve Hilton, who was, for about 7 years, the Prime Minister's chief strategist. He moved to California, but's back this week to launch the paperback issue of his book, More Human. It's a kind of personal manifesto for transferring power from the state to the people. And to do this, he says, then Britain has to vote to leave the EU. He joins me now. So, Steve, how exactly is the EU, in your phrase, less human?
I think it's actually at the heart of what I've been arguing for and fighting for all my time in politics, which is people power. The EU, to me, is one of the most clear representations of almost everything that's gone wrong with the world in the last few decades, as we've seen more and more power being centralised. It's being centralised in government, where you've seen the growth of this centralizing bureaucratic way of solving problems. But you're seeing it in the economy too, where you're seeing big corporations taking more and more power and control in their respective sectors. So there's less competition, less choice. And so when you take all that together, what it adds up to is a world which is, I think, becoming everything, all the systems and structures of the modern world is just becoming too big and bureaucratic and distant from the human scale. And that is, I think, at the heart of the anger and frustration that people are feeling, not just here in the UK, but in Europe and even in America, with the way the world runs at the moment.
Now, many people who want Brexit have been advocating these kind of freedoms, but what makes you different is that you speak with experience of government. You've said how you went into Number 10, and you were shocked to find out that only a third of what you were doing was your government's agenda, and the rest of it was created by the machine, and about a third of it from the EU. Was it?
More than that, a majority from the EU.
So can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's a point which we haven't really heard much about. I mean, that what the government does, we assume the government is doing because the voters told them to do it. You're saying that the majority of what the government does, it does because it's been told to do it by Brussels.
Yes, and I want to be really precise about this so that people aren't getting a distorted picture of it. The first point to make is that a lot of this is generated domestically. And so when we think about the bureaucracy and regulation that people have to experience, it's not all coming from the EU. A lot of it is domestic. I think it'd be wrong to blame the EU for everything that's wrong. Secondly, when we look at the amount of stuff that's coming from the EU, much of which is not just stuff that we don't want or nobody here has voted for, but that is often not even particularly well understood by the people who have to, by the officials in Brussels and here that have to. Well, just the complexity of the regulations and the complexity of the directives, and there's a particular British aspect to this, which means that we over apply the directives, right? And that is, and when we challenged that, for example, there was a very interesting answer, which was, well, you have to do that because of the British legal system, the historic origins of our system, the common law system, which is different to the European system. That means you can't just do what other countries do, which is say, here's this intentional thing from the EU, do what you want with it and just note it. In the British system, you have to be very precise about what its implications are for people in their daily lives, and that's why we have that. But the point I wanted to make about the origin of all this is that much of the content, let's just describe it in a neutral term, that's coming from the EU, is actually agreed to by Britain. So it's not correct to say that this is imposed on us. Mm. In those meetings in various parts of the Brussels setup, the Council and the Parliament and the Commission and so on, very often we go along with things. Now, these aren't real numbers, but to give you a sense of it, let's just imagine that, let's use the numbers that we've been talking about, that 30% of things are perfectly reasonable things that we would want to see happen. And there's 70% coming from the EU that we don't want. In order, we don't have a veto. A lot of these things are all negotiated, and there's a process by which you can get rid of the stuff that you don't want and keep the stuff that you do. But that's a negotiation. So to get, let's say there's 70 items that you don't want. In order to really get anywhere, you have to say, well, we're going to have to compromise and give away some of it. What are the five that we really don't want? Let's really focus on winning those arguments, because there are five things that are going to be, in our view, really damaging. In order to win the argument on those five, you have to concede the 65. And that's how you end up with a lot of this action and activity that we officially have actually said yes to, but we've only done that because it's the only way possible of protecting ourselves against the stuff that we think is really damaging. And the consequence of all of that put together is that the British, well, the system as a whole, if you take together the ministers and the advisors and the civil service, there's so much of this to process and deal with. The time and energy that it takes up in central government, I think, is something that most people would just be shocked to discover.
Are you surprised to see how few of the people you were number 10 with are now saying, well, it's time to leave the EU? Because at the time, I certainly remember hearing that Oliver Letwin decided it was time to leave the EU. It was the only way of dealing with this problem.
Yes, Oliver had a very, very strong point of view that was the only way of dealing with it. I don't know what his position is today.
But if you were in government right now, you would know that a prime minister can't walk away saying, actually, my renegotiation has failed, I'm going to advocate leaving the EU. That would be a huge admission of failure. So from the moment this referendum was declared and the renegotiation strategy announced, politically, there isn't another option open to him, is there? No matter, he might think exactly what you think, but still, politically, he wouldn't be able to say it.
Well, I hate to introduce Donald Trump into the conversation, but I think it's actually highly relevant at this moment.
He's for Brexit as well.
Well, one of the points he makes is that in a negotiation, and he has a lot of experience, and as he keeps reminding audiences, he wrote The Art of the Deal. He said that anyone, if you want to do well in negotiation, the most important thing is that you have to show that you're prepared to walk away. The whole point of the negotiation is to say it could go either way, and what it depends on is what I get in these negotiations. So I think that there's no in principle reason that the die was cast at the beginning of the process.
Right, but would you have voted to stay in the EU had the deal been different?
I definitely could have imagined a situation where reluctantly and with no great enthusiasm, I would have said, yep, fair enough, we should stay. But I think we're a long way from that.
And how much of a renegotiation would you say that we've got? Do we have a renegotiation that's worth the name?
No, I don't think that there's any sense in which the EU has been reformed as a result of this process.
Okay. Do you think the Prime Minister will speak to you again after your intervention in this? I had thought you'd just keep your silence in California, but you're another little Brexit bomb dropped in his...
Well, the thing is that, the truth is that this is, in many ways, the fight of my life. Every single thing I've done in my life, one way or another, has been driven by this incredibly fierce belief in people power and a real loathing of and contempt for anything and anyone that tries to stand in its way. That's why I first backed Mrs. Thatcher as a kid when it was really socially embarrassing to do that, because I felt that she was fighting for working people and was fighting against the establishment that were trying to put people in their place. It's why I backed John Major. It's why I started my company, Good Business. It's why I joined David Cameron's team. It's why I've started Crowdpack, the tech company that I founded in California, which is all about taking on the big party establishment machines and giving politics back to people. One way or another, this is what has driven my entire life. So for me to sit that out was just not something I could, in all conscience, do.
Your parents came to Britain from Soviet-controlled Hungary, and the EU surely represents a healing of a massive rift. So is there not an emotional part of you that thinks, yes, it might have its problems, it's a bureaucratic nightmare, but the EU represents the unity of a continent that once had an iron curtain dividing it. My parents were once on the wrong side of the iron curtain. Now we're together as one polity. That is a beautiful creation and something worth voting to keep.
Not at all. It's the opposite. My family, they're all in Hungary still. now, my family all hates the EU. They hate the way that it is doing this, all the things that I complain about, the way that you're seeing this bureaucratic centralization, the homogenization of their culture and their economy. They can't stand the EU. And I'm sure there'll be other Hungarians who love the EU, so I'm not trying to represent a whole country through the lens of my family. But I think the broader argument is that it's not the EU that's done that, it's NATO that's done that, because in the end, the fall of the Soviet Empire was driven by the defense and security and military resolve of the Western powers through NATO. And this referendum is not about leaving NATO.
Steve Hilton, thank you very much. Now onto our final item. Has this song turned out to be prophetic? Eight years ago, Beyoncé's Single Ladies sounded the alarm over a shortage, not of men, but of marriable men. In 2016, that shortage has become acute, according to Ariane Shireen. She writes in this week's magazine about the lengths to which British women now go to find love. She joins me now, along with Cosmo Landesman. So, Ariane, tell us about your latest adventure.
I went on a very exciting and strange adventure to a night called Romancing the Armpit, where I was invited to sniff strangers' armpits through a little cup. Hairy, unfragranced armpits for the most part, although there were some women's armpits too, and I have to say that they were slightly more fragrant than the men's. And it was all in aid of finding love through the science of pheromones.
Right, and the idea is that if you sniff somebody with whom you're compatible, then something will click inside you and do you start to fancy an armpit smell?
That is the theory. In practice, it was disgusting and vaguely traumatic, but I think that women go to these lengths now to find partners because there's so few men left who are suitable.
Cosmo, is this a trick that you've missed, perhaps picking up women by the smell of your armpits?
It certainly is a trick I've missed, and I'm glad I've missed it. I'm old-fashioned. I'm old school. I don't go for the armpits. I like the idea of, you know, meeting a woman charmed by her other attributes other than her armpits. And also, it's a very unromantic notion, this whole idea of love through, love at first whiff. Because imagine if you actually met someone and your child said, how did you meet mommy? And you say, oh, I sniffed her one night at a dating thing. It's not a great story that you're part of the family.
Is that any worse than saying, well, I saw her on Tinder?
Nobody gets married on Tinder. I don't think you have to worry about that.
But Ariane, I imagine the women we've tried the romantic thing. They've done everything Cosmo would probably recommend, the candlelit dinners, and it won't be working, and they'll think, right, it's now time to take more drastic steps. What I can't work out is, for every unattached woman, there will be an unattached man. So why do we tend to hear about the agony of a single ladies and not that of the men?
Because unfortunately, all the hot men, like you and Cosmo, get snapped up so early and our best prospect is of you divorcing.
There's another answer to that. Statistically, there's a great glut of more educated women than men. Men of a certain socioeconomic group do not match up to women of the comparable group that they want.
You mean there's a kind of snobbery, Cosmo, amongst the graduate women who are thinking, I want a graduate man.
I want a nice, smart, very successful graduate man. And the proportion of those in terms of the population of a certain age group, women are in the minority.
That may be true, but I think most of us would rather meet Mr. Right than Mr. All Right. We don't want to settle for a man who is, you know, frankly, a bit of a loser. That sounds quite harsh, but I think it's true.
Wait, so let's define loser.
Maybe somebody who doesn't have a great job, maybe a fishmonger or a bin man. I think that, you know, my aspirations, I'm a very ambitious person. I don't think that they would match up to those of a refuse collector.
Cosmo, is it the case that men don't have the same expectations? That they want to find somebody to find a soulmate, but they don't necessarily want somebody to enter joint competitions for Mensa?
I think the difference is that, yes, men want certain boxes ticked. Women want all the boxes ticked. And if they don't get all their boxes ticked, it's goodbye, Charlie. Man, we get 3 boxes, we'll go for that.
Ariana, the kind of women you met at this armpit sniffing night, what were they like?
Professional and perhaps slightly over-eager to meet somebody because their biological clocks were ticking down and they thought, if it's not now, it's never.
And what are the other techniques that they would use when they're not armpit sniffing? What else are they doing?
Well, there is shush dating, which is silent speed dating, which I believe Cosmo has done. There is killing kittens, which is a masked ball. There is Playdate London, which is an arts and crafts-based dating night.
Right, it sounds like there'd never been more ways of meeting men.
That's what's happened, is that the dating market is fragmented into niche marketing, where you can find anything you want, whether it's armpits or men with beards, ginger-haired men, also men who like to dress up in clown outfits. It's a vast market out there that anyone can have a pick
at. Love has become consumerized then, Cosmo.
Yes, totally.
And Ariane, it sounds as if you might only be interested in somebody of a certain, dare I say it, income.
I wouldn't say it's to do with income. I would say that it's to do with compatibility. And I'm really sorry, but I just can't see myself being with a bin man.
That isn't the alternative, by the way, but, you know, between Steve Jobs and the bin man. There's a happy middle there somewhere, I think we should remember.
So, Cosmo, if Ariane does improve her techniques, moves away from armpit sniffing, what chance do you think she's got of finding love in this great city of ours?
Very good chance. She's incredibly attractive, very funny, very smart, and writes for The Spectator. I thought she'd be undated with it often.
So what dating techniques would you recommend?
I say go back to actually meeting someone, conversation, a cocktail in a bar. You can't beat a cocktail in a nice bar talking as an introduction and way of wooing a person.
That's true, but you can't really go into a bar and, you know, approach the nearest guy and say, hey, would you like to go for a candlelit
dinner? Why not? Be bold. Only the brave get the fare.
Okay, Cosmo, would you like to go for a candlelit dinner?
I certainly would.
Right, at this stage, we'll just tiptoe away quietly, thank Ariane and Cosmo. And while they plan their candlelit dinner, you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special, incredibly cheap subscription rate to The Spectator of 22 issues for just £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22. Thanks for listening. I'm Fraser Nelson, and this podcast was produced by Tom Goodenough.